In the United States, one of the most misunderstood biblical teachings is that of the Christian and the use of alcohol. Does the Bible teach total abstinence, or does it teach that it may be used in moderation? Some use fear, guilt, ignorance of the subject, and misexplanation of scriptures to teach total abstinence. Churches do. Religions do. As a nation, we went through a period of prohibition because of extreme teaching on this subject. 1920, 18th Amendment to the Constitution, total prohibition. 1933, 21st Amendment to the Constitution, rescinded the 18th. But many states continued to have total abstinence even after the 21st Amendment. I'm going to Kansas, my wife and I are, and Kansas is one that has restricted it, let's put it that way, and over the years it has changed. When we were in North Carolina, certain counties had complete prohibition. I lived in such a county, Randolph County, just outside of Guilford County of Greensboro, North Carolina. We were across the line. Utah, the Mormon religion out there, there is you cannot buy it like you can in other states, whereas California and Arizona, you can go into any grocery store and buy whatever you would like. But that's not always been the case in a lot of states, and there has been prohibition, and there still is in counties within states, and usually controlled by the dominant church religion in that county or in that state. What does the Bible teach on this subject? Let's look into the subject of the Christian and the use of alcohol. Now, before we get into the Bible, let's cover some preliminary facts about alcohol and alcoholism. Some people are predisposed to alcoholism. Some are genetically predisposed because of a history in the family. The Bible talks about sins that can be carried on to the third and fourth generation if it's been something, in this case, totally misused. Obviously, when a woman is pregnant, she should not be having any, be drinking any alcoholic beverages or anything like that. We know in this day and age what it does and goes to the fetus and so forth and all of that. Some races, either Asiatic or Indians, for example, and ethnic groups, have less tolerance than other groups do. It's just a fact, and it is just that way. Men have more tolerance than women do when it comes to being able to drink something of an alcoholic beverage. People who know that they may be predisposed to alcoholism must practice discretion and wisdom about it. And some do not in any way drink, period. Depending on their background and circumstances, they may not be able to moderately drink at all. And that is very true. That does not mean that the Bible teaches or requires the remaining majority population to practice total abstinence. And yet that is something over the last 150 years, in the United States at least, was being forced upon people. Out in Kansas back in the 1880s, 1890s, Carrie Nation led the revolt by women against any alcohol in bars or anything like that coming down, and with axes and clubs and everything, and going to run them out and smash the windows and do great damage, and they did. And eventually, by the end of World War I, and when it came to an end about a year or two later, the 18th Amendment was passed by 38 states to become part of the Constitution. And but it was making everybody had to abstain totally from the use of that. A lot of it was just plain ignorance. And what I want to do today is look at what does the Bible say, what does it not say. And there's obvious things where people who have had a problem or their families had a problem, they should not drink or do it. Now you take our president, President Trump, his brother, younger or older, I forgot which now, died quite a long time ago of alcoholism. Acute alcoholism took his life. And I remember hearing Mr. Trump being interviewed, it's probably a year ago now, that he has never drank because of that. And he will not drink a glass of wine. He will not do anything when he saw what it did to his brother. And that's his choice, that he is, and that's very good. And he has kept to that all these years in his life. Now, alcohol is not found in the Bible. Where does alcohol, the word alcohol, come from? Well, it's derived from the Arabic word alcohol, meaning essence. It's spelled A-L-K-U-H-L, but pronounced the same way. I have a book here that I've used before and thought it was very balanced. It's entitled Under the Influence by Dr. James Milam and Catherine Ketchum. And let me just read it here. First of all, I may refer to a few quotes here from that book as we go along. Distillation, which was discovered about AD 800 in Arabia, is the man-made process designed to take over where the vulnerable yeast fungus leaves off. The distilled or hard liquors, including brandy, gin, whiskey, scotch, rye, bourbon, rum, and vodka, contain between 40 and 75% pure alcohol. Pure alcohol is also added to fortify wines such as port and sherry, boosting their percentage of alcohol to 18 or 20%. So distillation, that was something that was learned in the Arab world. Of course, now in the Arab world, it's all Islam and Muslim, so they don't drink, period. But it's interesting that that process was discovered around 800 AD in the Arabic world, and the word. We have the word in our language, alcohol, alcohol, I guess maybe it's how they would pronounce it, but almost spelled exactly the same as alcohol. And so we use that word commonly when we're speaking of that. You don't find the word, like I said, in the Bible. Now, alcohol, as was distilled beverages and so forth, from which I just read the quote from, it is not the strong drink in the Old Testament. You find wine and strong drink. The strong drink in the Old Testament is from the Hebrew word shikar, S-H-E-K-A-R, S-H-E-K-A-R. And that was a stronger wine. It was a wine. Now, one needs to be more careful with distilled alcohol. Hopefully, we would think of that and understand. I mean, some of these things are really... I recall when we were on a cruise many, many years ago, and we stopped in... where did we stop? We stopped at the Grand Cayman Island, the town of Georgetown, their capital. And we went through... what was it? It was a rum factory where they produced rum. And there were several, we went through a place where some fish hatchery or whatever. It was tours where the boat is stopped for the day. Well, we went through the rum factory, I recall. They had rum there at 150 proof. I mean, talk about a poison. And what is that doing to your body, you know, to drink? I guess people buy it or they wouldn't make it. And now the one thing they did have good there was the rum cake. But a lot of that's baked out of it by baking the cake. That is a delicious cake, I'll say that. I didn't get high on it either. but it was I've had people, we have a lady up in the church in North Carolina makes rum cake. But it's baked out and is really quite good and delicious. Well, let me move along here. obviously, distilled alcohol has a higher percentage of alcohol and other chemicals with it. This type of alcohol is not discussed or used in the Bible. Hard liquor, we'll call it, is not part of, you won't find it in the Bible. It is not there. It wasn't even developed during the time the Bible was being written. Well, how should we approach the subject of the Christian and the use or non-use, whatever the case may be, of alcohol? Let's look at a couple scriptures here to begin with. Let's go to 1 Thessalonians chapter 5 and verse 21. There is common scripture. I'll just read it to you. Test all things and hold fast what is good. Test all things, hold fast what is good. Now, why? Because there are, as I will go along and mention, a number of churches even to this day that teach that it is a sin to ever have anything of alcohol in any way whatsoever in your life. But is that what the Bible teaches? And of course, it's that kind of teaching that led to prohibition back almost 100 years ago now. In Acts 17 and verse 11, Acts 17 and in verse 11, here we have the story of the Bereans. Again, you're familiar with this. These were more fair-minded than those in Thessalonica in that they received the word with all readiness, and they searched the scriptures daily to find out whether these things were so. Well, we're going to search the scriptures to find out if these things are so, about whether one should be in total abstinence, whether one should be very careful and not, and how to use it. One other one before I then actually get into some of these things. Let's go to 2 Peter 3 and verse 18. I kind of wanted to set this as a backdrop, you might say. 2 Peter 3 and verse 18, he says, "But grow in the grace and knowledge of our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ." We are to grow in both biblical and secular knowledge. In this case today, we're going to see a little, certainly quite a bit of the biblical, as well as some of the secular knowledge about it. And we should prove things, we should be open-minded, and we should also learn to be responsible with it as we come to that knowledge. So let's now go to the Bible on this subject with that in mind. We're going to grow in some grace and knowledge about this, because there's been a lot of ignorance and misuse of scriptures by churches and denominations for quite a long time. In the Old Testament, there are two words that are translated as wine, and it's important to know these words. Yayin, Y-A-Y-I-N, Yayin. That is strictly wine. The other one is Tirosh, T-I-R-O-S-H, Tirosh, and it is translated as new wine in the Old Testament. So you have Yayin, wine, and Tirosh, new wine. Those who argue for abstinence want to say that Tirosh is unfermented wine or grape juice, because unfermented wine is grape juice. Is there such a thing as unfermented wine? I've been into the Total Wine Store. I think it was up in when I was in North Carolina, and they have them around the country. We have one over there in Fort Myers. And I was in there because when we were in South Africa, they raise a lot of grapes and produce a lot of wine in the Western Cape of South Africa. And I was interested. I remember when we came back from South Africa, well, does the Total Wine Store, they sell wine from all over the world and bring it in there. And sure enough, they had South African wines. I thought that was very interesting. But I turned around to go somewhere, and here, well, up here was this sign, unfermented wine. And I thought, unfermented wine? If it's not fermented, it's not wine. And oinos is the Greek word in the New Testament. It means fermented wine. Now, my wife was telling me that they can take the alcohol out of wine. There's a process that they can actually do that. I can't say that I'm familiar with it. All right, fine. Well, you do that, and it then becomes unfermented. And it just returns to being grape juice if you can do that. So anyhow, going on here with some of the things here from my notes. pick up here. Okay, yes. Now, is there such a thing as unfermented wine? The answer is no, there is not. They want to call it that. They want to say that because they know the word in the Bible is wine. It means exactly that, wine. So a lot of times people will argue, but it was unfermented wine. I remember one particular religious man on television was talking about how that my Savior would never, referring to John chapter 2, we'll go to later, my Savior would never drink wine. That was unfermented wine. Well, somebody forgot to tell John when he wrote the story that it was unfermented, as we will see later. People get very impassioned over this, but not from the point of view of knowledge. And that's the sad point. Is Tirosh grape juice? Well, the International Standard Bible Encyclopedia has a good comment about that. Tarash, or new wine, was wine from the most recent harvest, while old wine was wine from the previous year, Yayin. Both Yayin and Tarash are fermented grape juice with alcoholic content. Hence, both are able to cause intoxication, as Hosea 4 verse 11 in parentheses says, and are to be distinguished from must, M-U-S-T, or unfermented grape juice. Unfermented grape juice. And yes, so both of them are wine. One is on the previous, the present year's harvest, and the other is at least a year old and probably aging. Now let's look at some scriptures. Let's go to Genesis 9, verse 20 through 21. Here we'll see the first misuse of it following the flood. Genesis verse 9 and verse 20 and 21. Noah began to be a farmer, and he planted a vineyard. And then he drank of the wine and was drunk and became uncovered in his tent. Now, there's probably a number of reasons. I don't know how he did not understand or have control. But you read later in Ezekiel, the 14th chapter. I'll not turn there to save time. Ezekiel 14, verse 14, and again in verse 20, it's repeated, where you will see that Noah was called a righteous man twice in that same chapter. He was one, a very righteous man, Daniel, Noah, and Job, a very righteous man. Obviously, he didn't continue to get drunk, but he did get drunk one time. Now, I don't know if it has something to do with after the flood, because the waters above the firmament had come down to cause the waters on the earth. Was there something different in the atmosphere as far as when he was drinking it, that it went to his head quicker than before the flood, when he would have, this wasn't something new. By the way, isn't it interesting that he knew how to raise, he must have had him on the ark, some sort of plant to be able to plant the vineyard, you know. So it was something that they were doing even long before the coming of the flood. And it goes all the way back to the beginning, actually. And so, yes, this is not here, because this is, it shows that this was a misuse of it. Now let's go forward in Genesis to chapter 14, where Abraham, after he has rescued his nephew Lot, he comes up to what later would be Jerusalem, to Melchizedek. And Melchizedek, it's interesting what he did in verse 18. Then Melchizedek, who was king of Salem, brought out bread and, guess what, wine. And it's not Tarash, it's Yayin. It is the old wine that is a previous year and it's aged. Even better. And he was the priest of God Most High. The priest of God Most High. Now, he offered not only bread, but wine. Not unfermented wine. It was fermented. And it was the real thing. Now, I think we know who Melchizedek was. He later was Jesus Christ. Let's just review a couple scriptures here. Notice in Psalm chapter 110, the most quoted psalm in the New Testament is Psalm 110. In Psalm 110 and verse 1, the Lord said to my Lord, sit on my right hand till I make your enemies your footstool. And then in verse 4, the Lord has sworn and will not relent. You, who is you? That Lord. You are a priest forever according to the order of Melchizedek. Now, we see this in the book of Hebrews. Chapter 7 in particular. Paul keeps mentioning to his audience that he's writing to that Jesus Christ is our high priest after the order of Melchizedek. Now, one of the interesting things in the book of Hebrews is that the 11th chapter, it's called the faith chapter. It lists everybody there who was righteous, starting with Abel, Enoch, Noah, Abraham, Then it goes to the Isaac and Jacob, of course, Sarah, then Isaac and Jacob. Who's missing? Melchizedek. Verse 13 says, all these died without inheriting the promises. What about Melchizedek? Well, Melchizedek was never given the promises. Only those people there listed were given the promises. He gave the promises. He didn't receive the promises. And Paul clearly is showing in the book of Hebrews, in chapter 7, verse 1, without genealogy, no beginning of days and no end of years. And Jesus Christ would become our high priest after the order of himself. He appeared to Abraham after the flood in the little village of Salem as Melchizedek and was what? Priest of the Most High God. Now, the reason this is important to bring this up in this subject we're talking about here today is he offered Abraham bread and wine. And did God sin? Now, you have to ask people that believe you can never, you have to totally abstain. Well, then, did God go back on? There's no commandment. So how do you know it's a sin? And why? I mean, the Mormon religion, many other religions, also even to this day teach you don't touch it in any way. God touched it, and he offered it to Abraham. And so there's something more that we need to learn about this. Are there problems that people can have? Absolutely. Absolutely. And if they are they have a proclivity toward that problem, and what in this case on the alcohol, they better not touch it. They're not commanded to touch it. Nor is everybody else commanded not to, who it may not affect in any way, or as long as it's used in moderation. All right. Okay, we see in Genesis 14 Melchizedek gave it to Abraham. Let's go to Genesis 27. Genesis 27. And verse 26. Now this is at the time of the Isaac giving the birthright, even though it was by deception, he was giving it to Jacob instead of to Esau. And yet it still was something that would stay because of the oath that it was given under. Verse 27, he came near and he kissed him and he smelled the smell of the clothing and blessed him and said, surely the smell of my son is like the smell of a field which the Lord has blessed. I can't see because he was virtually blind. It does smell like indeed this is Esau, but it wasn't. Therefore, may God give you of the dew of heaven and of the fatness of the earth and plenty of grain and wine. Plenty of grain and wine. Your descendants will have that. And let people serve you and nations bow down to you and be master over your brethren and let your mother's sons bow down to you. Cursed be everyone who curses you and blessed be those who bless you. Part of the original promise there given to Abraham. Now, yes, he was being blessed with vineyards. Now, I've talked a little bit about the origins of our country, and yes, this nation has been blessed in many, many ways. And when it comes to vineyards, if you want to go out to the West Coast in California, take Highway 101, which is like a freeway going up north and south. But as you go north, up through the center of California, I mean, just look to your left and right, and it's just vineyards everywhere. You've never seen and didn't realize how many, and they're all over these hills, everything. You don't need level ground for vineyards. It goes up and down and everywhere. And if there's an inch of ground left, they'll plant another plant there. But it is everywhere. And all the way up to the Napa Valley and up north, up into Santa Clara and all of that north of San Francisco. You go up to Oregon and Washington State. Lots of vineyards, a lot of them really, and since I've been growing up out there, I've been amazed. I didn't know of it or see of it when I was just a young kid growing up there in the 50s and early 60s, but Today, I mean, you get all kinds of wineries everywhere out there, and they sell it across the country. And Washington State there, what is it, Chateau Saint-Michel? My brother lived right next to the winery there, that is their main one. And he would take us over there when we would be visiting on tours and everything to see it and walk through it. Very interesting. And it's very good wine, too, that they produce. But all of that, Columbia River Gorge and vineyards up there, Hood River, the Dalles and areas, on up into eastern Washington State. I mean, things have changed over the years. In fact, I think some of the grounds that they grow it on up there is better than California's. California was very good. By the way, a little side to this, when you go to Canada, you won't see too many U.S. wines up there being sold. I don't know what the deal is, but if there's a big tariff on U.S. wines or what, but you won't see hardly any. Now, if you go to Quebec, you're going to see a lot of French wine, but no U.S. wine, and no California wines. So something's going on. I'm not sure what it is, but that seems quite unusual. All right, get back on track here. From Genesis 27, let's notice one thing in Exodus 29. Here, in as you're turning to Exodus 29, this has to do with the building, setting up the tabernacle, and also the for the sacrificial system that was going to be inaugurated. In Exodus 29 and verse 38, "Now this is what you shall offer on the altar: two lambs of the first year, day by day, continually. One lamb you shall offer in the morning, and the other lamb you shall offer at twilight," in the evening. Evening, morning sacrifices is what it was. Now, is that all there is? Is that all? No, there's something else that goes with those sacrifices. Verse 40, "With one lamb shall be one-tenth of an ephah of flour mixed with one-fourth of a hin," I don't know what a hin is, "of pressed oil, and one-fourth of a hin of wine as a drink offering." Wine as a drink offering. It was red wine, and that always was a part of the offering, was to have this red wine. Why that? Well, red wine was to be used in the drink offering. It pictured the blood of the future Christ. Very simple. It pictured the future, the blood. What did the lamb picture? The future Christ, the sacrificial lamb. And of course, the red wine pictured the blood that he would spill. And you know what? The Passover, he said this here, when it came to the wine, drink this, it is the what? The blood of the new covenant. That's what it represented. So God obviously used red wine. Now, he could have used grape juice. You can make red grape juice. Well, grape juice spoils. The wine doesn't. And God had in the sacrifices of the Old Testament era of time that there had to be red wine with the sacrifice of the lamb. And again, just to point out that God obviously is, it's not abstinence on his part. Yet churches, this whole nation at one time, went into complete total abstinence. And then you had all kinds of crime and the mafia and so forth bringing it in from Canada and during the 20s and all of that. Then you had people up distilling up in the mountains of the Appalachia. And, you know, you've seen all the stories of though they would take an old car and they would take the back seat out to put a tank in there. And, you know, they'd try to outrun the revenuers to take their moonshine and sell it. Why? Because of prohibition and everything. Those areas, by the way, continued like that well into 40s, 50s and 60s because those states and counties continued to practice complete prohibition, even though the 21st Amendment was supposed to have ended it, but it allowed states to decide individually and counties in states. Why? Because the churches in those states and counties dominated, that is, the legislatures. And that's today you have blue laws. You go to North Carolina, you go to a grocery store. On Sunday morning, you cannot buy, if you're having a church picnic, you want to buy some beer and take it along with you, you can't do it until 12:01. In some areas, you can't do it, period, on Sunday. Why? Well, obviously, it's religion that is dominating there, that people, the legislators and people do it to because they know if they want to get reelected, they better because of the area they live in. All right, let's go to Leviticus 23. This is something you probably have not noticed before. During the days of unleavened bread, the Passover, and on the day after the weekly Sabbath, we have what? The wave sheaf offering. So, as we've described it, they would take the priest would go out and get the first little bundle of barley that's growing and tie it up and bring it. And the wave sheaf pictured Jesus Christ. He said to the ladies, "Don't touch me, I have not risen," in John 20:17. But look here in Leviticus chapter 23, where the wave sheaf offering was introduced by God through Moses to the Israelites. Verse 9, "And the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, Speak to the children of Israel, and say to them that when you come into the land which I give you, and reap its harvest, then you shall bring a sheaf of the first fruits of your harvest to the priest." Okay, we usually stop right there, don't we? "And he shall wave the sheaf before the Lord to be accepted on your behalf. On the day after the Sabbath, the priest shall wave it." Look at verse 13. It's a grain offer. Well, I'll read it all. Verse 12. "And you shall offer on that day, along with this, when you wave the sheaf, a male lamb of the first year without blemish as a burnt offering to the Lord. Its grain offering shall be 2/10 of an ephah, and the fine flour mixed with oil, an offering made by fire to the Lord for a sweet aroma, and its drink offering shall be of wine, and 1/4 of a hen." And so along with that wave sheaf, there was a special offering, wasn't there, which included wine. So again, we see where it is used in the Old Testament. Now, am I saying that now the doors are open? No, hang on, because you're going to see that God warns also. He warns also, but we see that God is using it. Deuteronomy 14. Yes, now this one I want to take a moment here to comment on. This is at the feast. In Deuteronomy chapter 14, verse 25 and 26. "When you shall exchange it for money, that second tithe, and take the money in your hand and to go to the place which the Lord your God chooses, you shall spend that money for whatever your heart desires, for oxen or sheep, you know, good steaks, maybe lamb chops, maybe something like that, and for wine or similar drink, for whatever your heart desires, you shall eat there before the Lord your God, and you shall rejoice, you and your household." One of the sad things over the years in the Church of God, and not so much these years, but when we were a younger church, and people, I think, were younger overall, some people would take that and abuse it. And it happened more than once that somebody would get drunk at the feast, embarrassing both they and their family, as well as the church, and not exercising the responsibility that we certainly understand and teach here today that one should have. Yes, it was nothing wrong, but by the way, I'd be very careful about some of the, quote, hard liquors, which is where the word alcohol came from, the Arabs. And they have discovered it, but then as the Muslim religion took over all of the Middle East and everything, there is no alcohol. It is total prohibition. If you're going to India for the feast and you're flying out, going east, and you want to spend the night in Dubai, don't worry about it in the hotel or anything. There won't be anything there as far as any wine or anything like that if you wanted to have that. And if you're flying on their airlines, you won't find it as well. So it is a complete prohibition in the Muslim religion, like it is in the Mormon religion, and then I'm sure others too. It depends on in the Baptist religion. They will drink wine. They will in some areas, though it is a total prohibition. Randolph County, North Carolina. I know it is because I lived there, and I know what church saw that it stayed that way. Let me go along here. By the way, here in Deuteronomy, the word is Yayin. It is not the new, it is the old. Let me just give you a couple other examples, then we'll go to some warnings. Deuteronomy 18, verse 4. God gave the Levites wine. They were not to in any way come before God high. But he did give them wine. Maybe I should go there, just a couple pages. Deuteronomy 18, verse 1. The priests, the Levites, all the tribe of Levi shall have no part nor inheritance with Israel. They shall eat the things, they shall eat the offerings of the Lord made by fire in his portion. In other words, they had a part in the offerings. They could eat them after the was finished, that which was not consumed by fire. Then in verse 4, the first fruits of your grain and your wine, your new wine and your oil, and the first of the fleece of your sheep, you shall give him. Who? Levi. Israel, you give to Levi because he has no land to cultivate, has not been given. He has a service to me, God. And so the other tribes were to take care of the Levites. And one of the things that they were to give them was grain and new wine. New wine. And yes, God gave the Levites wine for their personal use, just as he did other things mentioned there, grain and so on as well. So, yes, but they had a responsibility, because if you come before God into the temple or later the tabernacle, later the temple, and you are high and drunk, you are in big trouble. You are in big trouble. And you cannot in any way serve God in that kind of capacity. In Judges 9 and verse 13 is an interesting statement made, I believe it's here in a kind of a parable. Judges chapter 9 and... let me get over there. Got Joshua. Let's get to Judges here. Judges chapter 9. Following the death of Gideon, his youngest son, Abimelech, killed 70 brothers. Gideon had multiple wives and children. And Abimelech, the youngest one here in chapter 9, he pronounced himself to be the king before Saul. And this is the only place where you find where there was a king in Israel, but only for 3 years before he's killed. A woman drops a big planter on top of his head and crushes his skull, if you read the whole story. There was one of the 70 brothers that was not killed by Abimelech's men. His name was Jotham in verse 7. And now when they told Jotham, because he hid, he went and stood on Mount Gerizim, and lifted his voice, and he cried out, and he said to them, "Listen to me, you men of Shechem, that God may listen to you. The trees once went forth to anoint a king over them, and they said to the olive tree, 'Reign over us.'" Yes, the people of Shechem did say that to Abimelech. "But the olive tree said to them, 'Should I cease giving my oil, with which they honor God and men, and go to sway over trees?'" He's using here figurative language, obviously. Well, anyhow, let's drop down verse 12. "Then the trees said to the vine, 'You come and reign over us.'" They wanted a king, by the way, and so Abimelech was offering himself to be the king, but in order to do it, he killed his brothers, 70. Verse 13, "But the vine said to them, 'Should I cease my new wine, which cheers both God and men, and go to sway over trees?'" Again, using figurative language about the tribes of Israel there and what they were doing. But it's interesting that comment was put in here, that new wine which cheers both God and men. Now, some people want to say, some churches want to say, that tarash, new wine, is unfermented wine. grape juice doesn't cheer like tarash will. And but it cheers God, it says. You know, interesting how God showed man how to develop wine long before the Noachian flood and to continue after the flood. He put it in the offerings. He offered it to Abraham. And it says here, yes, new wine can cheer God as well. God knows, obviously, how to control it. But interesting that that comment was put there. Now, there are a number, with that in mind, there are a number of scriptures we should look at that warn against abusing alcohol in the Old Testament by example or by statement. One I've already read, Genesis 9, that the example of Noah. Another one is in Genesis 19. I won't turn there. I'll tell you the story. You're familiar with it, I think. Genesis 19, verse 32 and 33. What happened? After Sodom and Gomorrah were destroyed and Lot's wife turned back, what did the daughters do? They gave the father wine because they wanted to get him so drunk that he would have relations with them and they would have children, of which they did, Ammon and Moab. He is responsible for allowing that to happen, though. Everybody, you can't say, well, they caused it. I think it goes along with what you're saying in the sermonette. They caused it. No. You are responsible. Noah, you were responsible. And anyone who allows himself to get drunk like this to where they don't know what they're doing, they are responsible. And yes, it is a sin. And that's one example there, wrong example, along with Noah's example. Another one, without turning to it, is in Exodus 32 and verse 6. Another wrong example. What happened in Exodus 32? The golden calf. And what did they do? Well, they were having quite an immoral party around that calf. And a lot of drinking. Verse 6. Exodus 32 verse 6. Now, where did they get it? There at Mount Sinai. Moses is up on the mount. They hadn't planted vineyards out there. Well, they obviously brought it out of Egypt with them. And as they brought many things out of Egypt, they didn't leave the wine behind. they brought that, but now that's a misuse of it. They were drunk and immoral both in worshiping this golden calf. And you can read it there in Exodus 32, 6. So it's a wrong example. That's not what we want. Another wrong example is in 2 Samuel 13, verse 28. 2 Samuel 13 and verse 28. David's son, Amnon, A-M-N-O-N, had relations with his daughter. What was his daughter's name? It starts with a T. I forgot the name. Temnar, I guess it was. Somebody said it?
Tamar.
Absalom wanted revenge for doing that to his sister. Actually, it's his half-sister. So he conspired. First of all, he tricked his father David, asking for permission to have all of the sons come over to his place. Well, why do you want them to come over to your place? Why do you want Abdon to come over? I've forgotten now what it says here. You can read the story. It's in 2 Samuel 13. It was an excuse, and he was lying to David. And he had his men, that is, Absalom had men, and he told them, once we get Abdon drunk and drinking and feeling real lightheaded, kill him. And that's exactly what happened, verse 28. Then the story came back to David that Absalom has killed all of your sons. And David, well, I use this term about freaked out. I mean, obviously, he was just really devastated. That maybe is not the correct way to put it. Anyhow, a couple verses later, somebody came to him and said, no, it wasn't all of your sons. Absalom just killed Amnon. But that was bad enough. Those are all examples of the misuse of alcohol. Then there are warnings. Not only are there wrong examples, but there are warnings against the misuse. Let's go to Isaiah chapter 5. Isaiah chapter 5. This is, again, all we haven't got to the New Testament yet. Isaiah 5 and verse 11. Woe to those who rise early in the morning that they may follow intoxicating drink, who continue until night till wine inflames them. People doing that are obviously alcoholics. They need help, all right. They have to want help, too. And we've seen people of that description probably in every generation, and certainly in our time as well. Sometimes people in the Church of God, a lot of times we've had recovering alcoholics in the Church of God. And why that happened, a lot of times, too, it was interesting listening to the sermonette. People get drunk and drink because why? Of the emotional difficulties they're going through and the stresses. And it gives them relief, it cheers, right? Like I said, they're in Judges. And that's not a reason to drink, because it will be destructive to the individual if they do that. And that is what a lot of people get into. You read about it in the paper, you read about it or hear about it in the television news, somebody, well, DUIs, it's so common. I've driven down the highway and see the police pull a guy over, and I can see they're checking him, walking the rope thing to see if he is drunk, how much he's had. It's not that uncommon. What do you do on New Year's Eve? The police have all these places, checkpoints. They want to check people to see what, especially when it's after dark later in the night, have you been drinking? How much do you have in you? All of that. People need to be very, very careful about those type of things. Now, it's not a sin or wrong to be able to enjoy a celebration of, but how much? People have to think. You don't just go in there and start drinking until the bottle is empty. And again, depending on, well, what are you drinking? Whether it's beer, beer can be very nice, very enjoyable to drink. Been to these restaurants and they have all these local breweries and everything. And they have really some very good beers. Now, some beers, it's like the Germans said when they had the Winter Olympics over in Austria a couple of years back, and Budweiser got the contract to serve the beer at the Olympics. And the Austrians and the Germans didn't like that. They called it Budwater. I have to admit some of it. Now, they do make some good ones as well. And I don't want to get off on that, but I mean, the point is that you can enjoy it. There are some good quality beers, good quality wines, and that are very enjoyable, but in moderation. And like the president, looking at what happened to his brother, he chooses not. That's perfectly fine. But that doesn't mean that everybody else has to do that. And that's the problem with the prohibition back in the 1920 through 33, and in many states and counties ever since. All right, let's look at Proverbs 20. Proverbs 20. Verse 1, wine is a mocker. Strong drink is a brawler, and whoever is led astray by it is not wise. So, again, looking at that, the strong drink was the wine that was of a stronger alcoholic beverage or content. In chapter 23, and in verse 23:21. For the drunkard and the glutton will come to poverty, and drowsiness will clothe a man with rags. Notice, as you go through the Old Testament, every generation had problems with alcohol. You notice that? There are warnings by God's prophets, God's people that he used to write the Bible, almost in every generation. And yet, God uses alcohol, that is, wine, red wine, giving it to Abraham, putting it in the offerings, using it at the feast. One could, all the uses. And the blessings to, what? Jacob and his sons, you will have grain and you will have wine. You will be blessed with vineyards, back there in Genesis 27. And that has been the case down through the years. Also, verse 31 through 35 here of chapter 23. In 31, do not look on the wine when it is red, when it sparkles in the cup, when it swirls around smoothly. At the last, it bites like a serpent, stings like a viper. Your eyes will see strange things. Why? It hasn't finished the fermentation yet, the process. It's still going through it. You don't drink it at that time. And your heart will utter perverse things. Yes, you will be like one who lies down in the midst of the sea, or like one who lies at the top of the mast, saying, they have struck me, but I was not hurt. They have beaten me, but I did not feel it. When shall I awake that I may seek another drink? Well, you're talking about the alcoholic. You're talking about here, you're drinking that stuff before it has finished the fermentation process. And that can really have some effect on a person. There are other scriptures of warnings. Just to save a little time, I won't go to them, but in Habakkuk 2, verse 15, in Micah 2, verse 11, and in Jeremiah 13, verses 12 through 15. Now, let me just summarize the Old Testament here. There is no commandment in the Old Testament saying, quote, thou shalt not drink wine or strong drink. It doesn't exist. And there isn't one in the New Testament, as we will see. Now, let's look at the New Testament. Let's go to John chapter 2. John 2. Of course, Jesus Christ was Melchizedek, as he appeared as Melchizedek to Abraham in the Old Testament. But now here he is, the Son of God. And as he began his ministry, in John 2, verse 1, on the third day there was a wedding in Cana of Galilee, and the mother of Jesus was there. Now both Jesus and his disciples were invited to the wedding. And when they ran out of wine, the mother of Jesus said to him, they've run out of wine. They have no more wine. Jesus said to her, woman, what does your concern have to do with me? My hour has not yet come. His mother said to the servants, whatever he says to you, do it. Now there were set there 6 water pots of stone, according to the manner of purification of the Jews, and they contained 20 or 30 gallons apiece of water. So Jesus said, well, look, fill the water pots with, well, now you're filling them with water. So they filled them up to the brim. He said to them, now draw some out now and take it to the master of the feast. And so they took it. When the master of the feast in verse 9 had tasted the water that was made wine and did not know where it came from, but the servants who had drawn the water knew, the master of the feast called the bridegroom. He said to him, well, you know, every man at the beginning of sets out the good wine, and when the guests have well drunk, then the inferior comes out last. Well, you've kept the good wine until now. Now, some people want to argue that this is unfermented wine, that certainly Jesus Christ would not. And furthermore, it's this quantity would be somewhere between 150 and 180 gallons of wine. I'll comment on that in a moment. Let me come back here and just kind of finish this. Verse 11. Now, this beginning of signs Jesus did in Cana of Galilee and manifested his glory, and his disciples believed in him. When they saw this, they saw it was real wine. And the master of the feast saw likewise that this was the real thing, the real deal, as we might say, of actual wine. Now, in getting back to the up to 180 gallons in those giant containers that was filled with water. Fred White, in his book, Manners and Customs of Bible Lands, page 134, had this to say. The wedding banquet was presided over by the ruler of the feast, as you see in John 2, verse 8 and 9. It was his duty to take care of the preparations, and during the feast, he would get around among the guests and see to it that they lacked nothing. He instructed servants in carrying out all the necessary details. The governor or ruler of the feast returned thanks at the dinner and pronounced benedictions at appointed times. He also blessed the wine. These wedding festivities with relatives and friends lasted for a whole week. Parentheses, Judges 14, verse 17. But the entire number of what was called the days of the marriage was 30 days. 30 days. So that's one answer as to the quantity of the wine that was there, because it was going to last. And the family, they went to where? Cana of Galilee. Well, I would assume probably the whole village of Cana was there. Everybody in those villages knew everybody. And there could have been quite a number, and that would certainly answer that. So it would not be unreasonable when one considers the number of people and the duration of these weddings and how long they would go on. Also, there would be food and there would be wine left over. And certainly there was a lot of food. By the way, when people do have something to drink in moderation, it should be with food. Should be with food. And it helps to absorb any of the alcohol so you don't, quote, suddenly get high. Do the abstinence people actually think that Jesus Christ would make 180 gallons of grape juice? That's kind of unusual when you think about that. And would the master of the feast, not knowing the miracle that took place, why, this is the finest grape juice I've ever had. No, he was talking about real wine there in verse 10 and 11. It was, in the Greek language, the word is oinos, O-I-N-O-S. It is fermented wine. It is not unfermented. It is fermented. All right, let's look at a couple more here and we'll finish up. Let's go to Mark 2. During his ministry, Mark chapter 2, Jesus said this in verse 22. And no one puts new wine into old wineskins, or else the new wine bursts the wineskins. The wine is spilled and the wineskins are ruined. But new wine must be put into new wineskins. Now, some say that new wine was grape juice being put into the new skins. Yet if you look, and again, I would like to read a quote here from the International Standard Bible Encyclopedia. It's a four-volume set, very good, very conservative. It said, in the saying about new wine in old wineskins, the new wine is the recent product of the harvest, which should not be placed in brittle, unpliant wineskins because it may burst them. In the process of, in the process of fermentation, carbon dioxide gas is released, creating pressure within the container. You'll find this is mentioned in Job 32, verse 19 as well. It wasn't something just only in Jesus' time, but anciently, you go back to the time of Job, about 1400 BC, 1500, close to 15, and Job 32, 10, 19, Job 32, 19, he mentions the same thing. No, the reason why you put the new wine into the new wine skins is because it's fermenting. Grape juice is not fermenting, so it didn't matter what wineskin you put it into if that's all you're developing or creating. Let's move on to Luke 7. Luke 7. Jesus admitted he drank wine. Now, I don't know how it is that I guess they just refused to look at this verse. But in not only Luke chapter 7, verse 33 and 34, but also Matthew 11, verse 18 and 19 says the same thing. But here in Luke 7, 33, for John the Baptist came neither eating bread nor drinking wine, and you say he has a demon. Now, the Son of Man has come eating and drinking. Yes, the Son of Man, me, Jesus. I came eating and I came drinking. I didn't have special fast days. Remember the Pharisees? I fast 2 days a week. I'm not like this sinner, this publican, when they went to the temple. Jesus didn't fast 2 days a week. He fasted before he began his ministry. Then we see, in fact, they said to Jesus' disciples, well, why don't they fast? You know, Matthew 6, because the bridegroom there is here. They don't need to. But when the bridegroom is gone, meaning himself, they will fast. So, but now at this time, Son of Man has come eating and drinking. And you say, look, a glutton and a wine bibber, an excessive drinker. You can be an excessive drinker without getting drunk. One has to be very careful about that. but quite an admission. He didn't deny it. He made wine. He drank wine. But he never got drunk. Nor was he ever an excessive drinker. He is the one that gave it to Abraham. He is the one that told them, when you come to make the offering and you kill the lamb, bring a quarter of a hin of wine with it. All through the scriptures you see that. He is also the one, through Isaiah, said, do not let yourself in any way become intoxicated and become a drunkard. No, that's important, I think, that we look at what does it say and what does it not say. In Matthew 26, a couple more here, Matthew 26, and this one I'm mentioning because of how it is misused by some. In Matthew 26 and in verse 29, well, I'll start in verse 27. Then he took the cup and gave thanks, and he gave it to them, saying, drink from it. This is the Passover, and all of you. For this is my blood of the new covenant, which is shed for many for the remission or forgiveness of sins. But I say to you, I will not drink of this fruit of the vine from now on until that day when I drink it new with you in my Father's kingdom. Now, some will say that the fruit of the vine is new wine or grape juice. Still wanting to insist that new wine is grape. It is not. It is fermenting when it is new wine. And it does have alcoholic content in it. All products that come from the grapes are, quote, the fruit of the vine. All products that come from grapes are the fruit of the vine. There is a scripture in Hosea 4, verse 11, for your information, in which it says, both wine and new wine enslave the heart, obviously by misuse. The wine and the new wine. What's the new wine? The one that's harvested in the present year and is in the process of going through fermentation. And it may be finished. I don't know how long it takes, several months or something. So you got quite a few months left in the year before you get into the next year. And, you know, you think about it. When are grapes harvested in the Middle East? August, September, maybe even up to early October. If you're making grape juice and it's going to spoil. You have no refrigeration until the Passover in the next spring. You have nothing new before the Passover. They will not come back on the vine again until the summer, and at the end of the summer is when you can begin to harvest what's on the vine. No, the wine will last and not spoil between harvest and spring Passover when it is to be taken here in verse 26. Furthermore, there is no grape juice at this time harvested in the spring in March. It has to be at the end of the summer. You harvest the grapes, but then you begin the fermentation process. All right, a couple more here. Let me finish up a few things here. Oh, I've got to tell you this one. This is an argument that has been brought up. Some have said that it had to be, here at the Passover, grape juice, because fermentation acts like leaven, and there could be no leaven at this time. Passover, unleavened bread, right here in this chapter. The process of fermentation does not cause anything to rise. It's not like leaven. It is no longer working when it is ready to drink. It has completed its process of fermentation. And it is the days of unleavened bread, not the days of unleavened wine. That is an argument that those people who insist, no matter what, don't tell me what the Bible says. I know my Savior would not drink wine. And this was a guy, a television evangelist. And I saw that when I was in North Carolina. And I believe his denomination still practices that to this day. Okay, let me go on. Let me go to Matthew 27. I'm right here in 26, 27:34. This is when when he's on the cross. And he was thirsty. So they gave him sour wine mingled with gall to drink. But when he had tasted it, he would not drink. Supposedly because he would not let alcohol touch his lips. But that, of course, is not the situation here that he's being talked about. He had just said earlier at the Passover that he would not drink it again until the kingdom. But notice what it was mixed with here. From the Expositor's Bible Commentary, there's this quote, "The myrrh, M-Y-R-R-H, tastes bitter." That's what the sour wine is. It's myrrh, M-Y-R-R-H. It tastes bitter, so a large dose of it mingled with wine would make the latter undrinkable. And that's why he did not drink it, because it was, they use the word here in the New King James, sour, but it really is what is called myrrh, and it is very bitter. And deliberately so, that he was not going to get any relief whatsoever. Now let's go over to Romans, Romans 14. This is important, and because there's a lesson in it for all of us. Romans 14 and verse 13 to start with. "Therefore, let us not judge one another anymore, but rather resolve this, not to put a stumbling block or a cause to fall in a brother's way." Now that might, some people would not eat in a restaurant on the Sabbath. And this principle here in verse 13 would certainly apply to those who would, and also to those who would not. Not judging one another. If you feel that way about it, fine. Well, look at verse 21. It is good neither to eat meat nor drink wine, nor do anything by which your brother stumbles or is offended or is made weak. That's one of the things that we even new people coming into Ambassador College as a freshman may come from a Bible Belt background, as we would call it in those days, and their understanding was it should be something never tasted. Well, you don't have anything there around until there's been time to teach in the classes what the Bible says and what Christ taught about it. And we should be that way toward one another. We don't want to offend anybody who is new and doesn't understand because of their background that they thought that was something evil and should never be touched. In Ephesians 5 and verse 18, I'll just give it to you, Paul warns against drunkenness. Ephesians 5 and verse 18. And in 1 Timothy chapter 5 and in verse 23, he recommends, Paul does, to Timothy, well, take a little, don't drink just water, take a little wine for your stomach's sake and many infirmities. Some say Timothy may have been under a Nazarite vow because he drank water. Well, there's no evidence that he was, but some will say that. Why would an evangelist, as he was called, put himself under a Nazarite vow? That's kind of ridiculous. Once he has come and accepted the sacrifice of Jesus Christ, that's no longer anything that is necessary. Also, some will say that Paul would not recommend wine since it would irritate a possible ulcer. So it wasn't really, it was unfermented. Take a little unfermented wine for your stomach and your problems. He certainly wouldn't recommend wine because that's true. It would upset an ulcer if that were the case. Again, this is all conjecture by those who have set their mind that they do not want to in any way use it, even in a responsible way. The Bible simply says that it was wine. Now, concluding here, there are a number of healthful benefits of alcohol and wine when used in moderation. I mentioned this book here, the Under the Influence by these two doctors. Very interesting book. This is one statement they had to make in it. It was a very balanced book, in my opinion. Numerous studies report that low doses of alcohol increase blood flow, accelerate heart rate, step up the conduction and transmission of nerve impulses, and excite simple spinal and brainstem reflexes. Performance on highly complex problem-solving tasks is improved with low doses of alcohol. Memory and concentration are sharpened, and creative thinking is enhanced. Again, low, not even moderate, but it does have that effect, as medically they have come to see. Also, from an article in Nature magazine, which was reported actually in the newspaper there when we were in North Carolina, researchers say They have discovered the key component in red wine that explains the so-called French paradox, or the way the French can eat lots of cheese, buttery sauces, and other rich foods that we all enjoy, but shouldn't eat, and still suffer less heart disease than Americans. The explanation is pigments known as polyphenols. The pigments are not present in white wine or rosé, and they seem to be less potent when they are present in grape juice. Polyphenols inhibit the production of a peptide that contributes to hardening of the arteries. Researchers report in today's issue of the journal Nature that the key message is moderate consumption of red wine is likely to prevent heart disease. And that's been around for quite a long time. I haven't heard anything to counter that. I remember watching it on 60 Minutes years ago when they did a special on why do the French, who drank red wine all like breakfast, lunch, and dinner all the time, if you've been over there, I haven't, but I've been told about it, that they do not, and yet they eat a lot of cheese. And so apparently there's something in the red wine, and that's what they've come to feel is the thing that would create it. One other thing, use of red wine, without turning to it, in Luke 10, verse 33 and 34, the Good Samaritan. You've heard the story of the Good Samaritan. Guy's beaten up, and he's laying on the roadside, and the Good Samaritan comes by, and he sees him. What's he do? Well, he begins to dress his wounds, first with olive oil for the softening, and he uses wine. Why? Red wine he had with him. Disinfectant. Disinfectant. And so, yes, it had very... What if he'd used grape juice? I'm going to pour grape juice on this guy's open wounds. What would that have done? With the sugars and everything in that? Probably really the bacteria would have had a great time in there with that. Anyhow... Just as a side. So, in conclusion, the Bible teaches moderation, responsibility, discretion. Some people should never be drinking. Certainly pregnant women should not be in any way drinking. And if people have had a history of it in their family, they shouldn't be drinking. That's one thing I like when I heard the interview there by the president. His brother died of alcohol. He won't drink. He has not drank for 40 some years because his brother died of alcoholism. Very good. And so likewise, we have to look at ourselves and make that determination. The Bible does not teach or require abstinence. It was used properly by Jesus Christ and by the apostles. And we can use it as well. Some of us can, some of us should not use it. But let's be sure that we use it, if we do, as a blessing, and not let it become a curse to us.